Whole Foods Market celebrates Earth Month with the Do Something Real Film Festival, a collection of six provocative, character-driven films focused on food, environmental issues, and everyday people with a greater vision. Come see one of the six features at City Cinemas Village East from Saturday, April 16th through Thursday, April 21st, every night at 6 p.m. Learn more about the films and special events at www.dosomethingreal.com. That's www.dosomethingreal.com. Sponsored by Whole Foods Market.
Boys, I'm mellow as a honeydew. Yeah.
That cat is high. Look that look in his eye. Oh man, he's high. Yes, higher than a kite. That cat is high.
It's 420, 2011. You're listening to The Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. In the studio today, we have bartender, brand ambassador, bar owner, bartender, Frank Cisneros.
What's up?
You've got a lot going on, Frank. You bartend at Dram, one of the best cocktail bars in Brooklyn.
Worst cocktail bars in Brooklyn.
Well, yeah.
Oh, wait, Abbott. No,
that's just a quote from some shitty magazines. part owner of The Drink, a fairly new bar, opened this winter.
Yeah, December 4th.
December 4th. Day before repeal day. That's cool. You currently work for Lucas Bowles, representing Bowles Geneva, as well as some of their other products.
Right, yeah. Bowles Geneva, that's kind of our flagship. Galliano, Damrak Gin, and new product called Vicari, which is a Sambuca.
Sweet. Literally. So how did you get wrapped up in this whole world? Like, what got you started in like drinks and bartending?
Man, it's a funny story. I guess it starts before I'm, like most people, starts before I'm legally able to drink. I was living in southwestern Washington State at the time, and I was vintage shopping one day, and I came across a copy of Boothby's World's Drinks and How to Mix Them. Mm-hmm. And it was an original copy. I had no idea what it was. It was maybe $5. It was just old, and I thought it was interesting. So I bought it, took it home. And I had a girlfriend at the time who had a little bit of money. And for my birthday, she built and stocked me a bar in my basement. So I was living in a place where, this is, you know, 2000 or something like that. There was no cocktail bars, let alone any bars at all, anywhere near where I lived.
And this was in Portland?
Washington at the time.
Washington.
It was right before I moved to Portland, Oregon. So I was, you know, maybe 20 years old or something. And I took about a year trying to mix every single drink I could in that drinks book. The really odd thing about it too is I lived with a couple of roommates who had a 13-year-old brother at the time, and he'd come over to the house all the time. I'd get maybe a little bit too inebriated to make my own drinks, so I taught him how to, you know, shake a Tom Collins. And the deal was, make me a Tom Collins, anything that's left over in the tin you can have a little sip of. So I think we both got a pretty good deal out of that. So, you know, at that time, there's no maraschino liqueur, no chartreuse. There's just all sorts of things in that book that I had no idea what they were. I remember moving to Portland, Oregon, and I walked into some, like, just horrible dive bar, and one of the first drinks I ever ordered was a Tom Collins, and it came, you know, came out of a gun. It was just, like, gin and a gun, and I was like, wait a second, you're not going to put super fine sugar in that and the juice of half a lemon? I was, like, so confused, and they were like, what are you talking about? And I was like, oh, whatever, never mind. So, like everyone else, I think I spent the next 5 years just not really worrying about classic cocktails. It was just an odd hobby. And for the most part, I was working as a DJ at the time in Portland, Oregon. When I wasn't DJing, I'd hop behind the bar and just do a dive bar bartend like everyone else was doing at the time. And I moved to New York City to continue my DJing career and randomly wound up working in the office of a restaurant. A really cool organic restaurant called Counter, which is now shut, I think just recently shut down. And I got really interested in wine. Part of my job was updating the wine list all the time. I just got really interested in the sort of idiosyncrasies of wine. To me, it was a lot like DJing. It was like these esoteric labels. You collect this esoteric knowledge, but your job is to kind of relay that knowledge at the right times and the right ways. And there was something kind of romantic about, you know, it was rock and roll to me in some weird way.
Yeah.
And it spoke to me the way that records did and DJing did. So I pursued that and got like a formal you know, degree in wine. I went through the SSA program and got a sommelier degree. Right when that was going on, though, it was like 2006, 2007. It's kind of like, again, the rock and roll reference. It's like the year punk broke, like that movie about 1991, like the year punk broke with like Nirvana and Mudhoney and all that kind of stuff. You know, obviously had amazing bars like Milk and Honey, Pagan Club, Flatiron that predated that. But 2006, 2007, 2008 is when you have Death and Company, PDT. And I found myself going to all these openings and all these amazing brands were being launched, like Absinthe brands. Geneva was launched in 2008. I remember being there and it was just like, whoa, it's just such a cool, vibrant time to be a part of it. And I was looking at these guys and going like, wow, these guys really know how to party.
Yeah.
Like a little bit more than the wine guys do.
Well, I always relate music with cocktails and with spirits. And I personally tend to name a lot of my cocktails after like a song or an album.
We both do that. Tanya Guffey does that too.
Totally.
I think Tom Chadwick does that. I think people like us that come from that music.
I think it's a pretty like standard thing for us to do. And also taking a name of a song and finding inspiration to make a cocktail.
Yeah, like the Hearts of Oak.
Like the Hearts of Oak.
Yeah.
Also about like going back, I think it's interesting, like, because I also am a pretty avid record collector as well. But that's also like the record collecting to me is, I think the way that it is the similarities that it has with like spirits and wine and cocktails. You know, we're constantly like this style of bartending. You are a collector. I mean, we're constantly like fleshing out our home bars with all kinds of rare bitters, vintage bottles of spirits, and like rare spirits that you can't get in the United States, specifically rums, like Cuban rums, to make like, you know, cool
Australian rums.
Yeah. Yeah. Inner Circle.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, old cocktail books, like you were just saying before, it's like, it's like a collector's hobby. It's like, this is kind of like a collector's lifestyle.
There's a total analog to it. I mean, that's a big part of it was, you know, when I met you and you hadn't come from, you were working for Linnell's previously to when I met you at Prime Meats.
Speaking of collecting.
Yeah. Which is like, that's like the no wave, like record collecting world of liquor was Linnell's. It was just like the dusty, crazy record store where you find the really cool stuff.
Yeah.
There's a total analog for it. I mean, there's like a beautiful sort of way that you can acquire that knowledge. And then you and I always talk about educating people in the right way about it too, which is something I've always thought. Like when you're a DJ, yeah, you might have the rarest, weirdest jam to throw out there to someone, but maybe if Madonna's going to be the thing that really gets them off, like that's your job. Just get them off.
Yeah.
So I think both you and I are pretty good at like
getting people off.
Yeah.
Just, yeah. I totally agree. I mean, like, you know, there's constantly like the common nowadays, you know, the whole issue with like vodka behind the bar, and you know, now there's like this backlash against like that backlash where we were like, yeah, let's just try something else, man.
I only drink vodka sodas now, just for the record.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Delicious.
Refreshing.
Actually, there's nothing more refreshing than a vodka, like a pint of vodka soda and a really hot summer's day, like on a rooftop. It's just like alcoholic water, man. It's like, it's not the worst thing.
I could say the same thing about a Tom Collins.
There's a time and a place for it. Yeah.
You know? Yeah, it is. It's like, that's where you get your hydration.
It's got water content.
I'm dehydrated. Give me some vodka.
It's fine.
So you were working at Counter, which was an all organic spot too.
So that was really interesting. I was there with Tanya Guffey. We brought on Nick Jarrett. I met Nick a few years back at Tales of the Cocktail. And he was working in Philadelphia at the time, and we were like, dude, you have to come up here and work in New York with us. So he'd come up. Dude was crazy. He was, you know, traveling up here one or two days a week and working behind the bar. So we were trying to, you know, come to put this beverage program together that was all organic. And this was, you know, a few years ago, there was nothing. There's no organic vermouth. There was one organic whiskey. There's no organic triple sec. So to try to put together a full bar program, we had to learn so much about infusing things and about how, you know, creating our own things. And we had very little really to look at. So we'd dig in old cocktail books and old recipe books and just try to approximate things the best we can. Again, this is at the same time that all these other bars are popping up. So that became really exciting. And that's when I kind of made the decision that I wanted to go back to this thing that at one point was my hobby. I was like, wow, I could really kind of make this my career. But I needed really like the muscle memory to do it. Like dive bar bartending is one thing, of course, but to really understand how to stir and how to shake and how to work with ice and all these different things, I had no idea.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough then to meet Tom Chadwick. Serendipitously enough, I lived across the street from this bar called Bushwick Country Club, mm-hmm. which is probably most famous for having invented the pickleback.
Right.
or at least popularized it in New York. He was working there. I was really good friends with the owner. And so we both started working happy hours there. And we kind of combined our happy hours. And he would bring in all of his own spirits, like Benedictine and Chartreuse and Maraschino liqueur, things that they don't have at a typical dive bar. And bringing all of his own ice, like he had access to a cold draft machine, so he's bringing in cold draft ice to this like literally like balls of the wall dive bar, bitters, all these different things, his own vintage coupes, and we'd make crazy cocktails for people. And essentially he taught me the muscle memory that I needed to put to my book knowledge. He cool. kind of rounded me out as a bartender. The same time I was hanging out a lot with this guy named Dave Catania,
Cachaça Dave,
yeah, who we know, yeah, we all know really well. Absolute great guy. And he was like, yeah, you know, this new bar is opening up called Prime Meats. You should go check them out. Mm-hmm. And I was like, all right, that's, yeah, cool. So I went down and that's where I met you.
Yeah, totally.
And I mean, I remember like sitting like, was it table one that we were at?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like bright sunny day. And I remember the very first thing I looked at was you had a drink that had Fernet Branca and Branca Menta. And I hadn't tried Branca Menta at the time. And I was like, whoa, this is crazy. How much Fernet's in this? And you're like, 3 ounces. And I was like, you have a drink with 3 ounces. I need to work for you. Like, whatever it takes, I have to work for you.
I remember I was up in the prep kitchen working on something. I probably making bitters or something. And someone came up to the prep kitchen to come find me. That's when I was interviewing that day. And they were like, there's some guy here named Frank with a mustache. He's got to be here for you. I was like, all right, cool. Then came down and the rest is history.
I think there was a time when someone named Tom Selleck came looking for you. Different sort of thing, though, I think.
That was different.
Yeah. Some sort of car chase was involved.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. That's weird.
So Prime Meats really was like where, like that was my big break. So thanks, buddy.
Yeah, no problem, man. My pleasure. And it was also where we started talking about to bring this back to a point you just said before, dive bar mixology. We always joked about dive bar mixology. And
your bar, where you used to work before, you kind of did that too.
Yeah, totally. But then there was also like,
well, when we stack glasses.
And make mimosas or, out of like orange soda and Miller High Life.
This actually brings up a really cool point. This goes out to all the bartenders out there too. Frank Brudy recently came to me and was asking me about serendipitous weird drinks that you come up with that just sound absolutely crazy. You know, we're known for making relatively precious cocktails with supreme ingredients, but every now and then we make something really weird. I was at Enzo Lim's new pop-up. Which I forget the name of it. It's this new Filipino like pop-up mm-hmm. brunch place, amazing food. And I noticed they had Tang on the menu and they had Campari on the back bar. And I was like, Tang and Campari would probably go really well together.
Yeah.
It's like an astronaut sunrise.
Yeah.
It's nice. So good. And Frank Rooney's like, really? That's good? And I was like, yeah, man, it's really, really good. And it turned out that also Enzo and Gardner Dunn had come up with that independently as well. It's just like one of those, like, everyone just kind of comes up with it. So any bartenders out there, you guys have come up with something really weird that, like, you know, Campari and Tang or orange soda and Andre, like, that's awesome. Let us know. Frank Rooney wants to hear about it.
Yeah. And when we get back from this quick break that we're going to take, we'll talk a little bit more about that. And we'll talk a little bit more about Bowles Geneva and the history of that. Also, Dram and the Drink. All right, back in a moment.
It has turned into crystal. There's a bluebird sitting on a branch. I guess I'll take my pistol. I've got it in my hand. Because he's on my land. And so the story ended. You know it all so well. Oh shit, you need, I'll tell you. The end. And
Yes, I see you sitting on the couch. I recognize your artillery.
This is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Take a swig of Beer Sessions Radio every Tuesday at 5 p.m. with Jimmy Carboni, the owner of Jimmy's No. 43, and Ray Dieter, owner of DBA. Beer-loving raconteurs offer toasts, share craft beer news, and swap anecdotes about their lives on the front lines of the craft beer movement. Again, Beer Sessions Radio, every Tuesday at 5 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
All right, we're back at the Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. Today, my guest is Frank Cisneros.
Hey.
Before we took the break, we were talking about different types of cocktail, like serendipitously similar cocktails around the scene. And also, we were basically just bullshitting a lot about drinks and bars like we normally do at the show. So on the subject of that, tell us a little bit more about the bar, the drink. Like, what was the inspiration behind this, and what do you do there? I mean, I know, like...
It's actually another really funny story. That, you know, it goes back almost 2 years. Like, in September, it'll be 2 years when we first started the concept. And when it first started, it was going to be a balls-of-the-wall, no-holds-barred beer and shot bar. It was going to be canned beers from all over, shots of whiskey in plastic cups, couches, like super cushy couches bolted to the floor, and like a cushioned front bar, like, you know, like the bar top itself would be cushioned, like you see in old man bars,
like Naga Hide, like,
kind exactly of, yeah totally. The whole point was to get as drunk as possible without being able to hurt yourself or anybody else. But one of the greatest things that I learned in the process of starting a bar, the best thing I could teach anybody, is that your concept never dictates the space. The space dictates the concept.
Right.
You can't go into some place with some beautiful, like, vaulted, exposed brick archways and be like, hey, I'm going to drop this with a bunch of plywood and just put in, like, a really shitty bar here.
Yeah.
And you just can't do it. Like, your heart breaks and you're like, God, this space is too good for it. So I have these amazing partners. You know, at the time, it was just a few guys, and it grew to, like, six really amazing people from disparate backgrounds. And, you know, Adam Collison just has an eye for design, and our boy Will Jones, he came from Spite and Dival, knows beer really well. So Will just kind of figured out, when we found the space that we found, which is on Manhattan between Grand and Mosher, it's 228 Manhattan, it just had this really beautiful open vibe. We all sat down one day, I think it was at BCC, and we were all talking about what we were going to do. And one of the things that connected us, that kind of brought us all together, was we all had this, like, nautical background. Nika Carlson, who's an old friend of mine from Oregon, who's Adam's girlfriend, she used to sail, I used to sail, Will still sails, everyone, you know, Adam grew up in Baltimore, a very, like, maritime town. So that was just, like, the one thing that bound us. And then it was kind of a logical hop, skip, and a jump to do Punch as well. Like, Punch is just such a nautical thing.
Yeah.
You know, at Prime Meats is when I really got into Punch.
Yeah.
Like, that, you know, I owe that to you, your daily Punch program. And that Punch program pushed us all to create new punches every single day.
Yeah, it was a good thing to, it's also like a mandatory practice, you know, of every day you got to make a punch, you got to be creative on the fly and come up with something delicious. It's going to sell. And
yeah, totally. Balanced and delicious. And yeah, you remember Pint of Punch?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Julian Brizzi.
Tell them a little bit about what Pint of Punch is.
Well, certain nights we would make too much punch, and by the end of the night there'd be a fair amount left over,
a pint or so,
and that would end up being someone's shift drink. They would drink a pint of punch,
and there's nothing more delicious. So yeah, it was great to kind of, like, you know, fall back on this great love of mine that I learned throughout the, you know, couple year and a half that I spent at Prime Meats. It just all naturally fit. And then we brought in chefs from Fetisau, Matt Lang. We have Eric Mann from Prune, who've all come on board. And they're doing the same sort of nautical thing with food. This whole kind of nod to self-sustainability. Mm-hmm. Like, we're growing, like, little herb garden in the backyard. And we're growing things like a few different types of mint, sage, rosemary. And those are things that are going to both go to season the food, which are, you know, house-cured fish, and also go into syrups that we use in the punches, and we just introduced a little brunch program. It's like a very humble brunch program where it's just like a bagel and a Bloody Mary, all high quality ingredients. We've like done everything in house, our own recipes, and it's kind of a fun alternative to having to wait in line for brunch and, you know, the really busy brunch neighborhood that Williamsburg is.
Right, totally. Yeah, so that's, and brunch is always kind of like a hard thing to pull off. And
And
you always hear people saying that brunch is for amateurs or brunch is for assholes. But,
I almost, after having worked several brunches at Prime Meats, I can't go to brunch anymore. I can't drink Bloody Marys anymore.
I know.
It breaks my heart.
I know. So going back to the program that you guys use at the drink. So you do punches and you do awesome beers and wine.
Yeah.
But you don't really label yourself as a cocktail bar.
Absolutely not. In fact, I just had one of our bartenders the other day ask, like, we're just coming out with a new menu for spring. Mm-hmm. And our menu lists, you know, about a dozen punches, our little food menu, our wines, and then a huge selection of bottled beers, which tend to be Belgian. Again, like, our beers are amazing. Our draft lines constantly change. And so it's like, you know, kind of watch the board for what's mm-hmm. on there. And, he asked me, well, why aren't we going to do any cocktails? Like, you don't want to put a cocktail list on there? And what I told him is when I first wrote our bar manual, the very first line says, we are not a cocktail bar.
Yeah.
However, that does not mean that every single one of us should not be able to make a great cocktail. We should all be able to make great cocktails. I think we're getting to a post cocktail sort of world, so to speak, in that, like, post cocktail bar world, in that we're at a point now where we have great bartenders that can make great cocktails. They don't necessarily need to be at the Death and Co's of the world. You don't necessarily need every single tool available to you to make a great cocktail. You can make a great cocktail with inferior ice or not the best spoon, or, you know, it's fine. It's just a matter of training, but more important, it's just a matter of caring. I mean, you can train a monkey to make a great cocktail. You can't train a monkey to care about cocktails, though.
Yeah.
If you care, you'll make a great one.
I think really, like, what you're saying is, to me, I mean, like, because I feel this way as well. I feel like, you know, with so many more cocktail bars, like classic cocktail bars opening, it's important for us to remember that this is only still like maybe 3% to maybe 2% of like the bars in New York City.
Yeah, there's like 40,000 bars in New York, something like that.
So, I mean, like, you and I might be a little bit jaded by this, but, I mean, the rest of the world, they're not. And it's still really important for them to find a place like that where they can get a quality drink, because they still can't get it everywhere.
So,
when people come to New York City, they're told where to go, and that's when they come see us or our buddies at, you know, Death & Company or Dram, you know. And really what it should be doing, the way we should be thinking about this, is that it's only making bartending across the board a more validated profession.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like a rising tide lifts all boats sort of scenario. So it's like, if you elevate the craft to this thing.
Nice nautical reference.
I'm wearing an anchor tie.
Anchor tie.
Just so you know. But I mean, just to bullet point it, I think if you were to wrap up the drink in one concept, it's a dive bar plus. It's a really unassuming place. We can make you a great cocktail if you'd like. Really, it's best to go there with a group of four friends, enjoy a bowl of punch. It's very reasonably priced. Our wells are all super inexpensive. The whole thing is to provide a great quality drink and experience with no fuss and no pretentiousness whatsoever.
Great. So tell us a little bit more about, you've been repping for Bulls Geneva now for
A little over a year now. Yeah.
Can you explain to our listeners, those who are unfamiliar with this product, what it is?
Cool, yeah. Geneva is amazing in that it's the predecessor to gin, but it's very much not a gin. Its story starts in the late 16th century. The easiest way to think of it, the Geneva that we have now, is like a precious whiskey-like distillate with gin-like botanicals.
Yeah.
So you have a very malty, unaged whiskey-like base to it, and that's the majority of what goes into the spirit. Then part of that is redistilled with juniper, where it becomes gin-like, and then you have a lot of your typical gin-like botanicals, things like angelica, clove, hops, which is a little atypical, and that gives like a floral aromatic high note. In like the late 17th century, the British tried to approximate Geneva. They weren't able to do so due to lack of distillation methods, access to grain, different things like that. And they came up with the London dry style of gin, which, you know, of course I love.
Right.
But Geneva was one of the great classic mixing spirits really up until Prohibition. It was outselling gin 6-1 in America. Mm-hmm. It was one of the dominant mixing spirits. All of us that were coming up in the cocktail world through the mid 2000s, we were looking at all these books like Harry Craddock, and we'd see Geneva in there, and we'd be like, what does it really taste like? Mm-hmm. I remember when Imbibe came out, David Wandrich said, you know, if you combine kind of one part Jameson and one part Plymouth, you kind of get towards where it's at. It's not a bad way of thinking of it. And so when Geneva finally came on the scene back in the United States in 2008, when it came back to the U.S., that is, it was really exciting for us because we could mix with this classic spirit and make all these classic drinks.
Right.
So to me, it was kind of a no-brainer when they were like, oh, would you like to come on and, you know, be a brand ambassador for us? I was like, yeah. What they represent to me as a bartender is exactly what I want to work with, and the way that they work with the bartending community, mm-hmm. I think is really positive. So I've been blessed to be a part of that. It's a fun brand to build.
And you've brought a bottle with you today, and
we've been sipping on it a little bit.
We've been sipping on it a little.
You want to talk about how we drink it in Holland? I'm not from Holland.
take us away.
We've got a couple little shot glasses here, and over in Holland, they would drink it out of two glasses. The whole adage is that you fill it to the very, very top because the Dutch are notoriously cheap. So when you fill it to the top, you're kind of proving that you're not giving like a skimp pour. So when you fill it to the top, it's so full that you can't really lift it up. So you have to lean over, slurp part of it, then you sip a beer, and then you drink the rest. Now it's called a kopstuja, which means baby headbutt.
You just made that up.
Yeah, totally. Just pull it out of my ass. No, it's called a baby headbutt because when you lean over and slurp it, you run the risk of, you know, hitting your head on the bar. So, all right. So you want to demonstrate one?
Sure.
All right. Here we go.
Okay.
You want to do a play by play of what I'm doing here?
Yes. He's pouring the Geneva into the shot glass. It's got full meniscus over the top. It's bowling over.
All right.
I'm kind of afraid.
We're gonna move them over by our mics a little bit.
So
we're gonna lean over and slurp first.
I'm gonna put the mic down next.
Yeah, time. let's get it in there. Ready?
All right, now we're gonna drink a little bit of Pilsner.
Pilsner.
So then you've got like the maltiness of the Geneva.
Right.
With the maltiness from the beer.
Exactly. I mean, that's the whole thing that separates it big time from gin is that it's extremely malty.
And, I mean, basically you have, like, a deconstructed Boilermaker here.
It's the predecessor to the Boilermaker. It's a predecessor to everything, let's be honest.
Yeah.
All right, so now we cheers. Prost.
All right. Prost. Excellent.
That's good Geneva.
That's good stuff. Well, thanks so much for bringing it on. Thanks for talking to us about your bars, about Bowles Geneva, and just it's really good to catch up with you, man.
Yeah, man, always.
Been a while. We don't get to see each other as often as we used to.
420, never forget.
Never forget.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks again to Frank Cisneros for coming on the show. Thanks to my producer, Jack Inslee. This has been The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte. We'll see you next week. Cheers.
Oh, man, he's high. Yes, higher than a kite. That cat is high.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. In 2010, EscapeMaker.com won an Emmy Award for their agritourism webisode, so this year they thought, why not bring agritourism and green getaway ideas right to you? Come to the Green Getaways Local Food and Travel Expo on April 30th at One Hanson Place, home of the Brooklyn Flea and former Williamsburg Savings Bank. presented by Amtrak, Zipcar, and I Love New York, the carbon-free event will be a day filled with food, prizes, workshops, and kids' activities. Over 50 getaway destinations, from counties to local farms and bed and breakfasts within a day's drive or train ride of New York City, will be exhibiting on the main floor and in the huge bank vault downstairs. See what's hot in sustainable travel and receive special show-only discounts. Grow NYC will be doing workshops on the Green Market, and Appalachian Mountain Club will offer workshops on adventure bicycling and hiking via mass transit. EscapeMaker.com will be giving away over 50 getaway prizes, ranging from zipline adventure passes to an overnight stay at Mohonk Mountain House. Travel greener, eat local. Come to the expo on April 30th. Get your tickets now at www.escapemaker.com. The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.